The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So my announcement is that since I spoke here last Monday, the next day, Tuesday, is when the president of our center, IMC, so Kim Allen, who's our president, she went to a title company and signed for the property in Scotts Valley that we bought so we can have our own retreat center. Wednesday, we got the keys, and Ted and Barb Wall moved in as temporary caretakers of the place. And Thursday, there was about 14 of us who showed up at the property kind of for, you know, the first time since we owned it. And I showed up relatively early. Weren't many people there yet. And I was so happy, so delighted. I thought, this is a better place than I thought. I said, that was nice. I was kind of surprised by that. I thought it was a good place, otherwise we wouldn't have pursued it. But I thought it was really, in terms of a good place to meditate, a good place for a retreat, it sounds really a good place. Still, quiet, beautiful, beautiful trees and ambiance around it. And it was a really happy thing to realize what we'd done, and now we owned it. And I have a key, even. And then we had a number of things to take care of there for the day. But then Kim McLaughlin, who helped us find the place, she and her daughter-in-law came and made this beautiful lunch for us. And the 14 of us who were there in the dining room had all the tables lined up in a big bouquet or whatever, big kind of thing. And we sat and had this wonderful, our first meal at the place. That was kind of special. So anyways, those of you who've been following this, I'm going to share that with you. It was kind of a nice news. So this evening, I'd like to talk a little bit about the context for a mindfulness practice. I've known people who have insisted, almost like their mantra, context is everything. And so it's one thing to practice mindfulness on a retreat. It's one thing to practice mindfulness on the path of liberation. It's another thing to practice mindfulness as a thief or an assassin. You know, you probably need a lot of mindfulness to pursue those particular career options. But it has a very different context for what you're doing and the purpose of it than on retreat or the path of liberation or some other situation. In the teachings of the Buddha, when he talked about mindfulness practice, not just mindfulness itself, but mindfulness practice, he defined it or described it oftentimes as three different qualities or three different things that come together. One of them is, in fact, the mindfulness itself, the capacity to be mindful, to be attentive. The second is to be ardent in the mindfulness. So, you know, mindfulness is not meant for the lazy. You know, you can't just sit and just wait, you know, patiently waiting for the mindfulness to come along. There has to be some application of mindfulness, some willful kind of attention to being attentive. And so the Buddha, in his context, felt that it was appropriate to be ardent, to do it with some great enthusiasm. And the third is what's called clear comprehension. So these three aspects together make up mindfulness practice. So mindfulness, ardency, and clear comprehension. And clear comprehension has a lot to do with the context in which you're doing the practice, that you understand the context in which you're doing it. When I came back from... I spent 8 months on a silent meditation retreat in Burma. And in that context, we were taught to do everything slowly, to be really mindful, minutely savoring each moment of mindfulness, each little gesture. So picking up a glass of water, I wouldn't just go and kind of pick it up and just bring it to my lips while I'm talking and just kind of wave it around. And I would be deliberate, and I would, if I was going to pick up the glass of water, I would deliberately be aware that's my intention, And I'd be aware of that, what it felt like to move my hand, stretch my hand out. And I'd do it kind of slowly to really feel what's there, really be present for it. And then if I felt the glass, when I felt it, I would feel the coolness of the glass and the smoothness of the round surface. And then I would feel the intention to grasp the glass, and then I would grasp it, and then I would slowly bring it up. And then as I brought it up, I would be there and just like and feel the first contact with my lips. And then I'd be aware of the intention to lift the glass up into my, you know, tip the water into my, and then, you know, it goes on and on. So it takes a while to do all this, right? So you don't just do it casually, drink a water, but you have to really present for it. And in that context of that kind of long, silent meditation retreat, it was great. It was really conducive to greater mindfulness. It was conducive to greater concentration. It preserved this very beautiful and helpful stillness in the mind that allowed for this deepening and deepening of the meditation that could happen there. So that was great in that context. After I came back from Burma, back to San Francisco, a few days later, I went down Market Street to go to the Bank of America to do some, you know, I don't know, open bank account or do something. And I was walking in off Market Street to open the door to Bank of America, and it was lifting my arm, stretching it, touching. And as I started to pull the door open, that slow, mindful way, I realized that this is not the context for this. I'm in the wrong place for this kind of mindfulness. Not what to be done here. And some of you who have been on retreat maybe have sometimes wondered about the lack of understanding the context of some of the other retreatants, when there's a bunch of you trying to get through a door and one person is slowly... Or sometimes if, you know, at the meal... And you know, there's a long line of people waiting to serve themselves, and one person is taking minute, you know, slow, careful attention to picking up each salad, each lettuce leaf, putting on their plate, and the next one. You know, they're having a good time. You're going to be happy for them, but it's the wrong context when you have all these people lined up waiting, standing there. So context is, you know, important. So this clear comprehension has a lot to do with understanding the context in which we're doing something, so a context of being mindful. So the first, so there's four aspects of clear comprehension, four things to clearly comprehend when we're practicing mindfulness. And these four apply to mindfulness in any situation at all. Anytime you're paying attention, when you're going to deliberately bring your attention to bear, to be more attentive to what's going on. Live deliberately. It's a beautiful thing. And so the first thing is to have clear understanding of the purpose, your purpose. So what's the purpose of the mindfulness? What's the purpose of what you're doing now? And some people have only a vague sense of what their purpose is, both in the moment, but also in the context of their wider life. You know, what's the purpose of their life? Sometimes people will be dismissive of, so when you ask, what's the purpose of life? But I think it's a profound thing for the heart to ask, to come out of a person, what's the purpose here? What's the meaning? When I was 15 or 16, I lived in a boarding school in high up in the mountains. And it was kind of an awesome mountain kind of environment, even though it was a very strict boarding school. I didn't realize it until I went there that it was a reform school. I wasn't sent there to be reformed, as far as I know, but I ended up there. And so I was there at this boarding school in a beautiful place, and I was walking down the road with an older friend who was older, he was 17, and I was just in awe of this beautiful mountainscape, mountain environment, and this great skies. And I said to him, kind of spontaneously, he said, you know, what does all this mean here? And he looked at me and said, don't be silly. And so I could feel something in my heart close. It took years for that to open up, to be willing to open that up again, that sense of awe or wondering what's about here. So to have the question of what's your purpose? It's a hard one to have. Sometimes it's a little painful to even ask a question when you're grinding away at some job that doesn't seem to have any purpose, and there's doesn't seem to be any possibility of anything else going on. It's not easy to even find work sometimes, and let alone switch jobs or directions of a life. But what's the purpose of your life? And one of the answers to that is it doesn't have to be about what you do. It might be about how you do it, how you live your life. And I think that's, in Buddhism, that's really the emphasis is the what is important, but the how is, the primary thing we're focusing on. How are you? Are you doing it with attention, with care? Are you doing it with kindness? Are you doing it with compassion? Are you doing it in order to develop yourself and to help others at the same time? The how you do something. And so what's the purpose you have? And what's the purpose of being mindful? Are you being mindful in order to be a better thief? Are you being mindful so that no one can catch you at work while you spend your hours looking at the computer and websites they shouldn't be looking at? You're really attentive, The slightest footstep down the hallway, you're alert, All your concentration, years of mindfulness and concentration, focused and not getting caught. And is that what you're doing? What you're using your attention for? Attention is something that's very precious. It's one of the most valuable resources we have. And what you apply your attention to, in a sense, comes back and feeds the purpose in which you're doing it. So if your purpose is to be secretive or to hide or to lie or to steal or do something, the attention, you can almost think of the attention you put into that as being like food that supports and strengthens that particular purpose that you're doing, or that tendency inside. If the purpose you have if your attention goes into being kind, being less attached, being less afraid, being less greedy or hateful, if your attention goes into trying to compassionately understand or be present for someone else, then that attention is like food that feeds those tendencies. And the question is, what do you want to feed? Your attention is going to feed something, because unless you're kind of like in a coma or something, maybe asleep, you're always paying attention. And so Buddhism teaches, actually, it's a very high consequence for where your attention goes. And if you don't take some responsibility for it, and just let you could take the easy way, just kind of continue with something that's maybe unwholesome or unskillful because it's easy. It might be easy and pleasant in the moment, but you're actually reinforcing and feeding tendencies which are not helpful. So the issue of purpose, why are you doing what you're doing, is a great question. Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you doing what you're doing in a big scale in your life, in a small scale? Even such a small scale as, why are you going to say what you're about to say? As some of you know, I like to point out that if you don't want to meditate, but you want to kind of go as deep into your mind, deep into understand yourself and how you operate, then only go through your daily life questioning very carefully why you're going to say what you say before you say it. And you'll find out all kinds of interesting things about yourself. I'm pretty sure of it. And it's probably not completely flattering, all of it. For some of you. Mm-hmm. And why are we doing what we're doing is a very interesting question. Because there's often a why operating kind of implicitly or even unconsciously, subconsciously, we're operating on a why, and many times we're not even conscious of it. To stop and ask, why am I doing this? What's going on? And then to look at your life and say, what is the purpose I would like to have? And what would be the purpose you would have if you were courageous? What would be the purpose you had if you weren't afraid? What would be the purpose you'd have for your life if you felt that there weren't any limitations to your capacity to do it? What would the purpose of your life be if you didn't feel limited by feelings of inadequacy or unworthiness or inability? Many people limit themselves and don't think boldly enough, or in Buddhist terms, nobly enough, because Buddhism, kind of the idea of becoming a noble one or to experience the noble liberation of the Buddhas. So for the context of what the Buddha was teaching about, mindfulness practice, purpose of mindfulness, is two things. Though sometimes he says it three ways. It's to benefit you with the highest benefit. It's to benefit oneself with the highest benefit. To benefit others. And the third thing is to benefit both self and others. And so then the question is, what is most beneficial is a really important one in Buddhism. What is most beneficial to you? What brings the most happiness? How do you know what benefit is? What is beneficial? A bigger bank account? More clothes? More status? More praise from your friends? What is it that's you know, really beneficial? And for Buddhism, what's most beneficial is found in your own heart. And your heart, for a heart to be settled on itself, for a heart to be at peace in itself, for a heart to dwell peacefully, subtly in itself, and not be fragmented, not to be spinning out, not to be contracted, not to be numbed, but the heart to feel vibrantly but beautifully at peace, without any sense of conflict, inner conflict, is one of the most beautiful and beneficial things you can do. So for the Buddha, the context of mindfulness practice was moving in that direction, trying to understand how to do that, to be mindful and attentive for that purpose. So the first these things, the context for mindfulness practice is a sense of purpose. And so it's well worth reflecting on what the purpose is you have for it. The second context, or this is called a clear comprehension, is the suitability, understanding the suitability of what you're doing, the suitability of purpose. So is what you're trying to do suitable given the context of the situation? So it might be that, you know, that in some situations in life, it's a suitable thing to do to focus on your own breathing and close your eyes and let go of any kind of external attention to the external world and just keep coming back to your breath, settle. And that's appropriate in some contexts. If you go, you know, to a wedding party or a funeral, or many places in life, it's not suitable for you to close your eyes and start getting concentrated in the breath and spend 40 minutes while they're doing the wedding. You know, what happened? You open your eyes and what happened? Are they married? You know, it's not suited in that kind of situation. It's not the purpose of that, so not suited. So is it suitable, the practice you're doing? Is it the right time and place for it? I've tried to meditate when my kids are really small. I would try to meditate early in the morning. Sometimes I even try to get up early. And lo and behold, those kids got up early. You know, two-year-old gets out of bed, you know, a three-year-old, you know. And if I try to keep meditating, generally it didn't work. Sometimes I had this brilliant idea that I would meditate with them and I'd put them on my lap, the little kid. And I had this, it was cold, I would have this big blanket I put over me and I'd wrap them in my blanket and said, this would be nice, and I'd sit there and think, oh, this must be a really good conditioning for kids, you know. Formative experience to be in their dad's lap and wrapped up, it's all cozy, and I'm being a great dad. You know, and how long would it last? Yeah. You know, and then, so I had to, you know, so it wasn't suitable, it wasn't the right time and place to do my meditation given that was what was going on. But then there's also the suitability of what practices are you going to do. There's a whole range of how you can practice mindfulness even, or meditation. And do you have the right practice for yourself and for the time and place that you're in? So, for example, there are some people, for example, you know, it's said that there are three universal meditations that are kind of suitable on all times. Mindfulness on breath, mindfulness of loving kindness, and mindfulness of death. Good all the time. That's what they say in the text. But I don't know if I believe that, because I've met people for whom breath meditation doesn't work. The first person that I worked with as a teacher around this, it took me a little while in the retreat to understand, because I kept kind of trying to help him to be with his breath, stay with his breath. And slowly, in the course of the retreat, it came out that now I forget what it was. He was either almost drowned or someone tried to choke him when he was a little kid. And that was such a traumatic experience that was still somehow lodged in his throat. And so for that particular retreat, we weren't going to go much further by having him focusing on his breath. It wasn't suitable. So there's a wonderful practice that's equally valid and significant as breath meditation, which is listening meditation, opening the mind, kind of choiceless awareness of sound around. And that worked for him great. And that was able to kind of settle him in a place that kind of went, in a sense, kind of bypassed the tension he had in his throat. And so then he was able to kind of relax in a deeper way, and that helped actually relax what was going on in his throat. And made his breathing a lot easier. So, you know, so there has to be some sense of, you know, not be blind or not be kind of, you know, committed to one way only, but to realize there are many different ways of practicing and what's suitable in this time and place. So when I sit and meditate, one of the things I will periodically check in about is, where should my attention go now? What's a suitable place, the most useful place for my attention to go when I meditate? Is it still with my breathing? Or is there some emotions going on, some feelings that need some attention, and so I'll do mindfulness of emotion? Or perhaps I'm aware of what's going on and I realize that what's needed the most is to bring my attention down into my body and really do mindfulness of the body, to find out, you know, find something, notice what's happening in the body, where the contraction is or where the tension is, or where what's energized or activated, and bring attention there. Sometimes what's suitable and appropriate is to go look at what's going on cognitively, to look at what I'm telling myself, the stories I'm telling myself, the beliefs I'm operating. And so there's some fluidity that at different times, different things, I bring my mindfulness to. They're all equally valid for cultivating mindfulness, but at different times, different ones are highlighted and need my attention. So to ask this question, what is a suitable place, what is a suitable thing to pay attention to right now, is a very, you know, very relevant question. Socially in the world, this was an interesting story, I thought, when I was in the Zen monastery in Japan. I went into the kitchen one evening, I think, and I was talking to one of the cooks. And the cooks was busy at chopping some vegetables. And he was at the chopping table, and I asked the question. And so he put down his knife, you know, let go of it, put it down, stood up straight and looked at me and answered my question. Very nice. So then he picked up his knife and started chopping again. So I asked him another question. And he put down his knife and answered me. And then he started chopping again. So I asked another question. He put down his knife and then he said to me, you know, when I'm practicing here, the way I practice here in the Zen monastery, I really try to do just one thing at a time. I'm either going to be chopping the vegetables or I'm going to be talking to you, but if I talk to you, I can't do my work. He was very kind about it, very matter-of-fact, very kind. And I realized that I was interrupting him. And I hadn't noticed the effect I had. I was slow to pick up the cues. So sometimes mindfulness is not to be mindful of your questions, your concerns, but rather to be mindful of what's happening in the context around you, the people around you. Sometimes we don't pay attention to ourselves. Maybe it's important to actually give more attention to what's happening to the people around us, understand them and what's happening, and take that in so we can know better how to be appropriate and what's needed in any situation. So the question of what is suitable now is a great one. And that's a little bit of a corrective, or not a corrective perhaps, but as a support to understand the first one, which is clear comprehension of purpose. Is the purpose you have, the particular purpose, is it appropriate for who you are, for the situation? If not, is there some other way of doing it? Is there another approach? The third context is, form of clear comprehension, things to be clearly be aware of, is the appropriate domain. This is a kind of strange topic, the domain. One way to get to what the Buddha meant by domain is to tell a story that he told, kind of a fable, of something like a pigeon that was caught by a crow or something, or a hawk, maybe a hawk. It's caught by a hawk, and the hawk was going to eat the poor pigeon. Delicious lunch. So the pigeon was out and about somewhere in a meadow or something, and the hawk came down and grabbed it. And so then the pigeon looked up at the hawk and said, "Well, you only caught me because I had left my domain, my proper domain, you know, my usual place, my realm, the place where I usually live and reside in. And if I'd been back in my usual domain, you wouldn't have caught me." And the hawk, being maybe a little bit overconfident, said, "Oh, I could catch you anywhere." So so the hawk put the pigeon down, and the pigeon went back into the kind of, I guess it was kind of a tilled field, it was all these clods of dirt, clods of the mud or dirt. And the hawk went up in the air, and as the hawk, you know, came gliding down to grab that, you know, sliding down, as hawks do, to grab that pigeon from that, the pigeon ducked behind one of those big clods. And the hawk crashed right in and died. So this story is told, this fable is told, the idea that if you leave your proper domain, you're in trouble. You could get in trouble. There's danger there. And you just stay in your domain, stay in your realm and your place. Now, this doesn't mean stay in your home and lock the doors. The proper domain for the Buddha is what he called the four foundations of mindfulness. To stay present for your bodily experience. Stay with your breath. Stay with your bodily experience. Be aware of what's going on. Be embodied as you go through the world. Be aware of your feelings as you go through the world. Be aware of the state of your mind, the quality of your mind. Because if your mind, if you're not aware of your state of your mind, you might act on that state in ways that are harmful for you. So, for example, if you're angry, be aware of that so you can be mindful and attentive. You don't act on your anger. I have a couple of times in the last, had the occasion to tell someone, you know, we'll have a hangout together, we'll do something, whatever, but you should realize that I'm kind of grumpy or grouchy. I'm just letting you know. And I thought it was, partly I was telling myself that, so I can be more cognizant of what I was doing and more careful as I went through, so I wouldn't kind of snarl or something. So to know what your state of mind is very helpful. And the last of these four is called dharmas, to be aware of some of the patterning, some of the inner processes going on inside of us while we're living our life, the mental processes going on. So here, mindfulness, the right domain, is to always have some presence in your own psychophysical processing, to know what's going on. And if you can be, and here the suggestion is if you're present enough at what's going on here, then you can be safe. The hawk's not going to get you. And so then you can go, if you have that kind of presence, you can go anywhere. And you bring your domain with you. So here, the clear comprehension about the domain means to know what you need to pay attention to, what you need to track as you go about. Now, I've known people who have not taken responsibility for their behavior. There's been maybe some major interpersonal conflict, anger and difficulty, and they somehow specialize at blaming other people. They never turn around and look at themselves. And it's very difficult to engage in a process of mediation or conversation or discussion with someone who's just always points the finger elsewhere and doesn't look here. I told a story recently many years ago of UPS delivery man brought this kid's play structure that we had an order, it was a gift someone distant relative sent us. And I was sick a little bit and it was raining, but it was an outdoor play structure, and the box said built in 10 minutes, you know, you can build it and put it together in 10 minutes. So it said, so I thought, oh, great. So I started trying to put this plastic thing, big thing together, and I don't know, after about 30, 45 minutes or so, I finally got it together, and you know, I was sick to begin with. And so I felt so much worse once I'd finished than I was before. I felt drained, and oh, what had I done? So I did the obvious thing, right? I blamed the UPS man. why did he bring, you know, today? But luckily, as soon as I saw that thought go through my mind, I laughed. I saw how ridiculous it was. The point being that if you keep your attention focused on who you blame, you're missing paying attention to where it's really useful to pay attention, the place where you can help the situation. It isn't that you're supposed to ignore the world around you, but the right domain for someone practicing mindfulness, the right domain for someone following a path to liberation, the right domain for someone who wants to live in the world with compassion, is to be connected to oneself well enough that you can track what goes on in your body, track what goes on in your feelings, track what goes on in your mind, and track some of the internal processes going on. So there's the clear comprehension of purpose, clear comprehension of suitability, what's suitable, clear comprehension of domain. The last is a clear comprehension of what's real. Now that's interesting. How do you know what's real? And that's a great philosophical quandrum, right? You can take philosophy classes and they'll discuss what's real. And I don't have a good answer for what's real. But what Buddhism teaches is that what life is, what our experience of life is not a thing, but processes. And so when we're trying to understand what's real in Buddhism, we're not trying to understand it's not a physics. We're trying to understand, you know, the true nature of reality. But rather, we're trying to understand the true nature of the processes with which we experience reality, with which we relate to reality. And so that is what's real enough, because the purpose of Buddhism is to know just enough about what's real to help you become free of suffering. It's not like you're a scientist that's really supposed to understand what's really real. We only need to know enough to understand how to be free. And for that purpose, we have to understand that our psychophysical way of experiencing ourselves and the world around us is a series of processes that come together, that arise and pass. that how we experience ourselves, how we experience the world, that way of experiencing it is a series of processes that are conditioned, fabricated, constructed, that arise. Are there because conditions come together to make them happen, and those conditions aren't there, they pass away. If we can really see this in a careful way, then we see that what's real is that we cannot attribute a permanent abiding self to any of those, that process. And so it isn't that we say that there really is no self. The Buddha never said that. What he said, what we see as real is we can't find a self in those things. And when the full range of what we experience is seen as being impermanent and no self is found in it, that allows the mind, or the heart if you prefer, to do something remarkable. And that allows the heart to open up and let go of what it's holding on to. Because deep in this kind of subconscious heart and mind, most people are always holding on to something. And it's very hard to kind of have the stillness and the focus and the concentration to touch this deeper subconscious place where we're clinging, often to self. And so the part of the function of seeing what's real in Buddhism is to see the impermanent nature of these processes and to see the not-selfness of these processes so that the heart can finally relax. And that's what the heart most wants to do anyway. The heart wants to relax. It's a lot of work to keep holding and being closed and tight and and afraid. And so to finally somehow let the heart open, relax, settle, and feel deeply at home in itself, so deeply at home that remarkably enough and beautifully enough, the heart disappears. What do you think of that? So context. So as we do, it can seem like a lot of things to keep in mind. It can seem like, oh no, now this Buddhism sounds very intellectual and analytical. It seemed before I understood mindfulness as being non-analytical, just kind of being present for things as they are. But there is no such things as naive, simple, present for things as they are. We'll always have some kind of context that the mind, life brings to the situation. And it's a natural thing to take into account, what is your purpose? Why are you doing what you're doing? Is it suitable? What's suitable given the situation you're in? And maybe it's unnatural to be connected to the proper domain. Maybe that's the Buddha's contribution to all this, is stay connected to yourself. Always stay connected. Even when you're talking to other people and helping other people, just have some connection here. And then know what's real so that you're not sidetracked by what is not real. And many people pursue what is not real because they think that's where their happiness is going to be. And that part of the function of mindfulness is to help to make that slowly be able to tease apart or separate out what is real and what is not. And because the real will support us. The not real won't. So that is... So then the last thing I'll say... one of the things I learned or was trained in when I did my Zen training before I did Vipassana practice was the value of doing things deliberately. So, you know, in Zen you wouldn't be so slow in picking up the glass and drinking it like you would on a Vipassana retreat. But you would do it deliberately and you'd give yourself completely over to drinking that cup of glass, that glass. In fact, in Zen, if you want to give yourself completely over drinking a glass of water, you wouldn't even pick it up with one hand. You'd pick it up with both hands, so you're really there. You're more completely there, present for it. You bring it with two hands and drink. There's a deliberateness to it, and so to bring an element of deliberateness to what you do in your life, to be deliberate about the purpose, to be deliberate about what you're doing right now, not casual and not like easygoing, whatever's fine. But to actually enter it deliberately is part of Zen training. And what and you might think, well, deliberate sounds willful, it sounds like a lot of self involved. But what happens when you do things deliberately, fully, the self-consciousness disappears. And it becomes, you know, in Zen they talk about just becoming one with that activity because you're so fully and deliberately there. And there's a way, a beautiful way in which the self can disappear, self's consciousness disappears, when you give yourself over deliberately to one task. When you're multitasking, it's hard to do that. Computer, phone. I've tried a few times to read email while I'm talking on the phone, and I'm very shocked and a little bit embarrassed. It doesn't work. What did you say? For me, it doesn't. But I tried. And I suppose some of you might have tried, too. Yeah. So this idea of clear, you know, there's four contexts, four clear comprehensions is in the Buddhist teachings is one way to help us live a deliberate life. And as we live more deliberately, hopefully all the things that bring you stress will fall away. Is that okay? So thank you very much.